Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. So we're here one pra night, getting towards the end of March, the end of the retreat. It's kind of difficult to think of what to talk about. We've had so many teachings the past few months that have been really informative, inspiring, leading us in good places, and hard to think of what else to to put into the mix. What's going to come out is maybe just bits and pieces of what it is that we've been talking about over this past several months. So it's natural, as we're getting close to the end of the retreat, to see the mind moving in different directions, oftentimes depending on how the quality of our retreat has been. Some people may have experienced what they would feel is a really good retreat. Some people may have experienced what they feel is a really lousy, horrible retreat. Probably quite a range in between the two. So watching what the mind does. How does the mind react to that now that the end is coming in a couple of weeks or so, less than that? Probably if it's been a really good, quote unquote, good, good in our how we define good retreat, there's a sense of, oh no, don't want it to end. Want to hold on to this, want to keep, why can't we do this? Why can't we do this all year round? If it's been difficult, stressful times, or even, or for the most part, then there's a sense of, oh, thank God, it's over, or almost over. Get back to the routine, get back to projects, get back to work, get back home, whatever it is, and get on with it. So just watching what how the mind reacts to these changing circumstances. One of the themes that we've picked up, contemplation of feeling, Vedana. You can sort of see that operating at this time. Remembering some of the teachings, like from the Chula Vedala Sutta, which was read out sometime in the past few weeks, parts of it, regarding feeling, tone, Vedana, and noticing how things are changing now as the retreat is looming, the end of retreat is looming. If it's been a very pleasant experience, if you've had a lot of good moments in whatever way from the practice, and it's been a very pleasant feeling, and it might be in the process of changing. And we know from the teaching that when pleasant feeling changes, it's felt as unpleasant, the loss of what's pleasant. Or if it's been a really unpleasant experience, we've experienced a lot of unpleasant feeling, and it's changing. What does that feel like now? Sense of relief, pleasant feeling. Oh, I have to do that. So just remembering that this is all a process of just picking up these practices, picking up these teachings, these reflections, and just watching them in the moment, seeing what's happening to the mind as it moves from one experience to another, as pleasant feeling fades, as painful feeling fades, and morphs into something different. How do our minds react? That's the whole teaching that we've been exploring, watching how the mind reacts to these changing circumstances. Or maybe we've been able to keep a, maybe there's some people who have been keeping a pretty steady pulse on this process and or who have been through a lot of retreats before and just see this process of change as it inevitably happens, and holding it with equanimity so that it's been just fine being on retreat, useful, beneficial, and it'll be okay when it stops too. Move into a different mode and see what happens. Everybody has different ways of reacting. That's the wonderful thing about this humanity that we find ourselves embodied in. It's so variable. We can all be here at the monastery following the same schedule, the same routine. Everybody's practicing together based on a schedule. When we have group practice, we're here at 5 in the morning. Everybody's eating breakfast at 7. We're all on the same practice schedule, walking, sitting through the morning, having the meal at the same time, eating the same food, having the same periods of structure in the afternoon, the evening. Some, of course, slight variations, but pretty much doing the same thing. And it's just amazing how that can be one person's heaven and another person's hell. kind of makes you wonder. But it really points out how our experience is all in the mind. I've also been talking a lot in the teachings about how these different kinds of feelings, when they're picked up and acted on, they lead to a movement of mind, a moving away from or a moving towards, depending on the quality of the experience. Craving to get, craving to be, craving to get away from, craving to not be. The whole world of becoming. It's been a theme, a topic. There's so many different kinds of this becoming that we pretty much constantly find ourselves involved with moment after moment. All the unskillful ways of becoming that we're all very familiar with, painfully so sometimes. All the ways that we work to get pleasant experience. All the realms from the realms of the senses. All the ways we move towards pleasant sights, sounds, tastes, sensations, thoughts, ideas, all the ways that we get repelled and react and try and get rid of, all the mental habits and personal habits of wanting to get praise, avoid blame, the worldly winds, you know, concerned about what people think about us. Gain, loss, pleasure, pain, all of that. Ways of becoming and the identities that we form around them. Also, there's a lot of skillful ways of becoming. There's been a lot of talk about this retreat, ways to use that process to cultivate skillful states of mind. It's still a process of becoming, but in a way that is leading to developing a basis of skill that leads in the direction of freedom, contentment, peace. So a lot of people have been working with different kinds of practices that help develop a skillful state of becoming. The opportunity has been here, and many people have benefited from developing quiet, still states of mind, deeper states of concentration. Some people have really enjoyed that aspect of the practice and worked towards this skillful state of becoming, developing very peaceful, quiet, inspired states of mind. Sometimes in the form of, you know, very rapturous experiences, very emotionally moving, energizing, sometimes even exciting states of mind from meditation. Sometimes maybe not quite so strong with all the bells and whistles, but deep feelings of pleasant experience, being in touch with the body, touch with the breathing, watching the natural rhythms, settling, quieting, stilling, a quiet form of peacefulness. All these various ways that we can approach softening the mind and allowing it to move into peacefulness. So some people have been really enjoying that aspect of it, aspect of the practice. That hasn't been happening for some people. Natural part of, again, the human variability. Some people just, it's not been that kind of a retreat. We've all had different retreat experiences probably over time, and sometimes it seems to settle into that experience, and other times it's nowhere near it. I remember one retreat as a layperson I had, it was actually at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. It was what I call my gray retreat. It was just one day after another of absolute nothing. It wasn't bad, it wasn't good, it was just thick and confusing and like being in a fog bank of grayness. And I never figured out why, it never made any sense, it was just that gray retreat. You never know what's going to happen. So maybe, you know, some people haven't experienced very much in the way of peaceful concentration. But maybe they've really enjoyed some of the teachings or some of the reflections, really getting into the suttas or the commentaries or the teachings from some of the ajahns, all of these things that have been explored and read out. And it's that can be a real enjoyable part of practice too, the comparing different teachings and contrasting teachings with each other, picking out bits and pieces that are really interesting and saying, oh, well, that appears over here too, and can you see how these relate to each other, and this is how certain points of Dhamma and practices tie in with each other, and or is there a contradiction here? And really kind of moving into those aspects of teaching that that are inspiring and interesting and good stuff to get your teeth into. So some people may have been enjoying those aspects of the retreat. Maybe some people have focused more on just the simplicity of following precepts, being in an environment where there's skill in how we compose ourselves or the conduct that we engage in, the ways of relating to each other with respect and truth and clarity with our intentions, seeing how precepts work that way. Or working with service, generosity, really developing that and experiencing the gladness of heart that comes from that aspect of practice on retreat. Maybe some people also have been really enjoying the reflections and practices around Samana Sanya, finding inspiring the teachings of some of the Kruba Ajahns from Thailand, and the lifestyle, working with the Samana Sanya, the perception of being in a monastic community, simplification, attention to detail with our daily activities, how we pick up things like use of requisites, sense restraint, working with food issues, sleep in the right amounts, different trainings from directly from our tradition, Samana Sanya. So there's a lot of different ways that people have used this retreat, maybe some in all combinations with each other, bits and pieces of each. All skillful ways of becoming, developing a set of attitudes and skills to support the practice. It's also important to keep in mind also that even as we develop these skillful means of becoming, it's so important to keep in mind the overall direction and goal of how we're using these and where they're going to take us. They're the raft that we're building to take us across the stream, across the river. And when we've used these practices, these trainings, for a purpose, we also need to know when to relinquish and to set down and to realize and understand the benefits of it, not just holding on to them, even if they're skillful. Not just holding on to them because they produce a certain state of mind that we like, that is skillful. But remembering, reflecting, that as much as we bring identification with them or objectification, using Ajahn Jeff's words, if we hold on to them with any of that sense of self or clinging, then we introduce an element of suffering into it. Like if we are really having a good time with the meditation practice, the concentration is coming easily, the mind is settling, and we attach to that or we crave that, we find that so compelling that we just want to get back, want to have more. And we find ourselves in the main area, you know, kind of just, oh, I can't, you know, too much activity, too many people, too much interaction. I just want to go back to my kuti, eat fast, do my dishes, get back, get out. Normally we encourage that. That's a good thing to do, not to get involved. But is that happening because there's a certain amount of aversion to engagement, the necessary kinds of things that are going on that we have to engage in? Do we just want to get back into our own quiet space where we don't have to bother with people? If there's any tendency towards that, then that's picking up something that's really good, but clinging too hard. And when it changes, when the situation changes, or when it's not quite the way we want it, then Notice the suffering that comes along with that. Notice the unsatisfactoriness of that kind of holding on to something that's a good thing. It becomes less of a good thing when we hold on to it. crave it. Or all the inspiring thoughts and ideas and teachings. If we keep them at that level of interest and inspiration on a intellectually reflective level, again, it's not a bad thing. It's still a good kind of becoming. But are we letting it really inform our practice? Are we taking it in and letting it move the mind towards relinquishment, towards letting go, towards stillness? Not a forced kind of stillness, but a natural inclination of really letting the teachings take us somewhere. And we actually have to put them down on that conceptual level once we've understood them. On that level, we have to understand them on the nonverbal level, on the intellectual level. We have to put them into practice. Are we willing to do that by setting them down? Practices of sila and dana, and another form of skillful becoming. Those are something we keep refreshing, keep doing as a foundation for our practice. But if we hold on to them, if we over-identify, if we use the precepts as a tool for judgment against ourselves or for others, by holding ourselves against a standard that sometimes we miss and we punish ourselves for, then that's not holding it in the right way. That's holding it too tightly. We can do that. Or, sometimes don't see it much happening here, but sometimes people can hold generosity in a way that's less than skillful too. I remember there was a story of an interaction that someone here had with a friend of hers. It was a person who was wanting to make an offering out of generosity, practicing generosity, and wanting to make an offering of food to a monk. And it was in the afternoon. And the monk said, well, it's the afternoon. I can't, I don't receive food in the afternoon. And the person who was offering it was extremely upset. It's like, you're denying me my opportunity to make merit by not accepting this food. And so I think the story was that the monk reluctantly agreed and accepted the food. So this person wouldn't be upset at them for denying her wish to make merit. And, when I heard this, my thought was, wow, that's, I don't know if forcing a monk to break his precepts is making a lot of merit. But, that's a perception sometimes. It was like to give something in the name of generosity, but with a strong wish for getting something in return. It almost becomes more of a transaction, hope to get something in return. So that would be a way of not holding the act of generosity very skillfully. So we have to watch our tendencies in these directions of using good things, but maybe in too tight or too ritualistic a way. And the same with our lifestyle, the whole process of monastic life for those of us who are in the monastery, committed to the practice and to the lifestyle, is feeling inspired to have the samana sanya, the perception of how we live a renunciate lifestyle. But are we attached to that? Are we forming an identity around it? Are we, wanting to become the best monk, the most perfect image of a forest monk, with our simple requisites and just a small set of material requisites hanging over one shoulder and our gloat over the other shoulder, walking through the forest. This is, a very commendable lifestyle, but if it's held up as this is who I want to become and it's, better than what other people are doing, and I, I'm a forest monk, I'm not a city monk, and what I'm doing is practicing the modest, sincere, pure way, it's taking a good thing and holding it in the wrong way again. Not saying anybody here is doing that, but I've seen that potential. I've seen that happen in other people, holding things like these images to a very high ideal standard, if we combine all of those things together as a set of images for ourselves, the forest dwelling monk whose concentration is wonderful, who keeps immaculate precepts and is the epitome of generosity and caring and kindness and extremely learned in the teachings and all of these kinds of things. And we've kind of set up an image of what we think is an ideal way to be. And if we don't live up to that, if we hold strongly onto any one or all of those images, we don't live up to it, then there's a dissonance, a sense of dissatisfaction, a sense of wavering. So being careful with even the skillful things that we pick up, being careful, wary of that identification that can come with that. We take that on. As Ajahn Sumedho says, when I think about myself, I get depressed. We take on all of these things. If we identify with them or form an identity around with them, then it just complicates everything. So there are a lot of skillful things we can do. And if we can also, as we go along, just not hold on to them, not identify with them as who we are or as mine, not cling to them, but use them as tools, put them down, pick them up when we need them, put them down when we don't, as forms of identity. Because the teaching, the realization of the teachings always keeps leading in the direction of relinquishment, of letting go, if we follow it truly. So there are times when it's important to pick up if we have some obstructions or some unskillful or difficult mind states. We need to pick up some tools and use them. Then when they help us release, help us let go of these tendencies, then we can put them to rest again, set them down, and watch the mind as it moves towards more peace, letting go, relinquishment, always moving in that direction. There's there's different ways of little other tools that we can pick up temporarily to help us with that too, different reflections to remind us to not keep getting lost in the future or lost in becoming or whether it's trying to get something or to be something or to get rid of something or to change something, to keep us turning back to what's happening right now. This is where we can really understand and let go, is in this moment. This is where that power to set things down, where that lies, is in this moment. And sometimes we have to pull ourselves back into it and need ways to help us do that. And I keep on coming back to something we've talked about quite a bit during this retreat too, and that's just the general reflection on death. How that's an immediate puller back to the present moment. if we just can remember to bring that reflection up. That's kind of actually coming to mind as Lungpa and I are planning to go to Ruth Dennison's memorial, leaving tomorrow afternoon for the memorial service on Saturday, thinking about the immediacy of that reflection on death can pull you back right into this present moment. You know, I was thinking probably sometime in the past couple of years, I don't know what Ruth's experience had been in terms of levels of activity and engagement in the past couple of years as her health has been failing, but somewhere probably within the past few years, she had her last retreat. I was thinking somewhere along the line, she probably taught her last retreat. I don't know if during that particular retreat, if she knew that it was her last retreat or knew it was going to be. Maybe she did, maybe she didn't. But there was that last retreat. And the people, probably some of the people that are going to be at the memorial service would be able to say that they were on Ruth Dennison's last retreat. And it just kind of struck me as quite significant that, you know, Ruth had her last retreat, and these people might have been at it. And I wonder how many of the people were thinking for themselves, this might be my last retreat. So we can reflect on that too. Maybe this is our last retreat for whatever reason. It kind of pulls us right back into the moment if we let it. Maybe we'll pass away. You know? Ruth isn't thinking anymore about what she might be doing after a retreat. You know, that's not happening. Sometime that will be for us too. We won't be thinking, you know, about what we're going back to or what we're getting into or what we're leaving. There'll be that time when that process stops. Where do we want the mind to be at that point? So bringing the immediacy of the moment back into consciousness. What if I don't make it to midnight even? Where do I want my mind to be? What do I want the quality of my mind to be? Do I want to be thinking about at the end of the retreat? What's going to be happening, for better or for worse? So using that reflection to bring us back to where we can see our own mind, see what's happening right here and now, and to keep moving towards relinquishment, towards letting go. This might be a good time of the retreat, with so many skills developed, to experiment with just letting go. I find myself, my mind moving in that direction, just of all the skillful things that I've picked up and refreshed and learned. I want to let those settle in the mind, but not on a conceptual level. And I just want to relinquish, to let go. I just want to experience that quality of release. Relinquishment. It's we've gone through the Anapanasati Sutta, and it's probably, you all remember, it's like the 16th, the last of the four tetrads, last point in the fourth tetrad, relinquishment. But even that, you know, we have to be careful with not to hold on to that as just an idea or a concept or a thing to do. You know, you've got, like, we've got even Anapanasati, you can take that as a list of things to do. You know, we've got 16 steps on a checklist. We've got, short breath, got that. Long breath, check. Whole body, check. You know, tranquilizing the whole body, check. Piti, sukha, check. The mind and calming the mind, check those off, and going through down the list and getting to the last four, relinquishment, check. Something else to do, you know. It's not what the sutta is intended for us to do. We're not just writing off a checklist. But relinquishment is actually a force in the mind of letting go, relaxing, releasing. One reflection, a sutta reflection that always helps me kind of get into that space of mind in an applicable way, in a way that really helps me move in that direction, is that is the Buddha's responding to a question from Kacchana Gotā. He asks the Buddha, you know, what is in what way is there right view? Asking the Buddha about right view, and the Buddha goes into a very brief but beautiful, brilliant exposition on how, for the most part, the world is caught in this duality of existence or non-existence, or more understandably as the view of eternalism versus the view of annihilationism, these as kind of spiritual viewpoints. And also, I think, you know, applicably to our present experience, the whole, we divide ourselves up into this often, this wish for this the becoming mind, the movement towards something, as we were saying, and the pleasant experience, or the movement away, the annihilation tendencies to get rid of, wanting to be, wanting to exist, wanting to get and acquire versus wanting to get rid of, wanting to not have to deal with, wanting to annihilate, and watching these aspects of our experience bounce back and forth. Oftentimes, we're not just one of those. We engage in bouncing back between the two of them. And how, if we can really see that if all things have their time and cease, pass away, there's a moment of experience and then it passes away. If we really understand the origin and cessation of our experiences, then we don't get caught in this duality. If we see how things always will constantly arise, the arising of different mind states, the arising of wanting to be, to exist, to get, to hold on to, if we see how those are arising, then and constantly arising, then we can't get lost in hoping for complete annihilation, endings, because things will always arise again. All phenomena will do that. Or getting caught, or if we see how things constantly cease, everything changes and moves on and ends, and we don't get caught in that holding, clinging, becoming state of mind. So watching this process of arising and ceasing to help us break the cycle of becoming. He says, all that arises is merely suffering. All that ceases is merely suffering. So really bringing the Dhamma lens into focus, seeing all experience through the lens of anicca, dukkha, anatta, just dukkha arising, just dukkha ceasing, so that we view our experience very closely around that, that in a very quiet state of mind, we watch our mind move towards something or move away from something. We watch that tendency of wanting to become or wanting to not become. And rather than getting involved with the objects that we're trying to get or trying to get away from, we just watch the process in that quiet state of mind and just see. Either one of them just induces a state of dukkha. It's stressful. This holding on to wanting or holding on to not wanting. And in that moment, if we see it clearly, we see that dukkha comes into existence. And we have the opportunity to let go, to relinquish. If we can do that, if we let go, relinquish that tendency, then dukkha ceases. There's that peace and relinquishment, cessation. And we watch it arise again. We grasp, we hold on to. Stress enters. And we recognize it if we can. Just let go, mental letting go, relinquishment. Open up. Let it be, let it move on, and watch closely. Dukkha ceases. Dukkha arising and ceasing. And if we're careful not to let the veil of self-perception get involved with any of it, then recognition, realization of all three of those characteristics comes together. It's just a process of dukkha arising and ceasing. It's not my dukkha arising and ceasing. It's not, there's no self involved with the process. And the natural tendency of the mind is just to let it all just be there. Let go. So even the skillful states of becoming, much less the unskillful states, we can just not grasp, not hold on to, use when we need to, pick up when we need to, set down when we don't need it. Be mindful, attentive, watch as the mind changes. If the mind starts to grasp again, we might need to pick up some tools, use them for a while, put them down. Just put it all to rest. Experiment with that as we go along. And just enjoy the cessation of becoming, or at least the perception of the cessation of becoming. We've been practicing the chanting for Ruth's memorial service, funeral service, and we'll be chanting the Anicca Vata Sankara part of it too. And I just keep coming back to that, you know, that third and fourth line, the Upajitua Nirujanti, Tesang Wupasamo Sukho, and the third line being. In regards to all compounded phenomena, in regards to all formations, how they disband as they are arising. If we see it clearly, they disband, all these different, even skillful activities of the mind. If we watch closely and attentively, we see how they disband as they arise right in that moment. And that's a sure If we see that, that's a sure trigger for us to be able to relinquish, to let go. And the last phrase there, in their complete stilling, is bliss. So it's in this letting go, this relinquishment, this complete stilling, where we find the true depth of peace. That's the goal of the practice. So we've got this next couple of weeks, maybe, if we're lucky. Hopefully, maybe we'll all make it through tonight, but we have this opportunity then this evening to just continue practicing, to settle down, watch the mind, see if the mind can move towards the goal of the practice, relinquishing, letting go. And use the opportunity that we have been given to put some of these thoughts into practice. So I'll leave it there for this evening.
Sadhu.